Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hello and welcome to Unfiltered with me, James O'Brien. My guest this week is the poet, playwright and Mercury Prize nominated, double Mercury Prize nominated rapper Kate Tempest. She's got a new book of poetry out in September called Running Upon the Wires. And as someone who's always struck me as being at the absolute extremities of self-expression, I'm genuinely nervous about interviewing her because I think she hates being interviewed. You don't like being interviewed, I've sensed in the past.
It's not that I don't like it when it's something interesting. I'll tell you what it is. I feel like when I can have a serious discussion, I really, really enjoy it. And in fact, I relish the opportunity to talk about the things that I'm passionate about. But occasionally, or in fact frequently, I feel like I'm either kind of condescended to or patronised or sensationalised, and it just gets a bit eggy, you know? It's like...
I do, I understand.
Also, people talk to artists in this really funny way sometimes, where they... when they interview you, as if you've kind of fallen from heaven, and like you've got all these interesting things to say about things you're not really qualified to be pontificating on. And instead of like having an interesting kind of meaty discussion about the stuff that you've developed expertise in or areas that you're really focused on, you're kind of pedestalized.
Yes.
And that isn't an enjoyable place to have a chat.
That's fame, isn't it? Is it because you are famous, you must be possessed of some quality that the rest of ordinary mortals don't? I mean, it's bollocks, obviously, but it's where perhaps the idea comes from.
I don't know if it's fame. I just think it's a kind of strange convention in how we've kind of learned to talk to artists. It's a misunderstanding of the craft.
Well, you've got me on my on tiptoes now then. You got...
I feel quite relaxed today.
You should, but I'm going to be editing my questions, I suspect, as I ask them. I thought it would also perhaps be to do with the importance of the right words that in your work. I mean, poetry, nothing is extraneous, is it? Everything is pared down to the absolute meaning, whereas in normal conversation, particularly perhaps with a slightly eggy journalist doing the interview, you can end up almost being misinterpreted or having your words afforded a significance or a meaning that you didn't intend, I think.
I always end up saying too much because I get nervous. I'm just one of those kind of people that you try and kind of put the other person at ease, quite naturally. Then I end up like talking too much and like revealing too much about myself. And then I just feel like it's not a very pleasant feeling when you kind of realise the next day, you're like, why did I tell that stranger who doesn't care anything about me all those things about how I feel?
And maybe they're good at their job.
Probably very good at their job. And I just need to get better at mine.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? You don't see this as part of the job. And also, you put so much into your work that, in a sense, you could be forgiven for thinking that there's nothing left to reveal in interviews or there's nothing left to do in interviews. Let's begin at the beginning. Born in Broccoli, 1985, one of five children. Your mum was a teacher. Your dad moved from the construction industry into law. Do you remember that happening? Was it a sort of conscious journey?
Well, my dad did loads of things. He wrote poems and he wrote plays and things like that. I don't think he ever put one on, but he used to muck around doing all those kind of things.
It was a creative house.
It was really creative. My mum did bits of teaching in Lewisham College. We lived in Lewisham. I moved to Broccoli later. She then stayed at home and was a housewife and a stay-at-home mum. That was probably when I was about 10, so I remember that. I remember when my dad was doing the law exams, I remember where he used to work in the house. I was, like, small enough to be... I must have been crawling around.
Happy times.
Yeah.
Well, why is that funny? I mean, because I'm interested in your childhood.
I feel like a bit...
Go on.
I feel like when you talk about your childhood...
Yeah.
Like, I'm actually not the best person to talk about my life as I recall it. Because to be frank with you, I think, like, my memory is actually not very good.
Fair enough.
And, like, there's lots of reasons for that, but...
Do you remember finding a voice?
Oh, this is the thing as well that people ask all the time, that when the kind of epiphany moment... When...
No, just when you first started expressing yourself creatively. Because not every kid does. I mean, I'm talking more than Crayola.
I remember always really enjoying reading. Like a hell of a lot. And I always used to feel very creative about the reading I was doing and the music I was listening to.
So when did you start writing?
Really young, I think, but not with the idea that that was anything unusual or...
No.
It was more that I loved writing stories.
And at home, it wouldn't be unusual because your dad was doing it. Your mum, when she was teaching, stories would be the currency at home, a big currency. Other homes wouldn't have that, so you wouldn't feel that you were doing anything special or particularly interesting.
Yeah, my dad used to make up lots of stories to us when we were young, and also my grandmother. She had loads of nursery rhymes and things like that. She used to be a nursery teacher, and she knew loads of very long kind of morality, you know, those old school, like Victorian,
yes,
really long rhymes about, like, a kid
going
to the
zoo. Hilaire Belloc and that kind of stuff, or even before that.
I don't know who that, like, they were just, it was just my grandma, I don't know.
Always had a moral message.
Yeah, they're quite dark.
They are quite dark. Yeah. I mean, the best children's stuff is really dark. It's the best children's writers understand the darkness. But this is going to be a tough interview, Kate, I can tell. But that's my lookout.
Why?
I don't know. You don't seem to enjoy talking about yourself very much. And we're here for an hour.
So we'll
get on to the work imminently. Tell me a bit about school.
Oh, yeah, I went to primary school in Deptford. It was really great. I went to secondary school in Kibbrook in a place called Thomas Tallis.
Were you happy at school? Did you have a good time?
I loved it up to a certain point. And then when I got to secondary school, I was not having such a good time and I stopped.
Why not?
Stopped attending. Well, just lots of reasons. Did you have a good time at school?
I was away at boarding school, so the comparisons are a little bit different. And yes and no would be the short answer. Looking back, probably had a better time than I realised at the time. But at the time, like most adolescents, and like you, actually, I found a lot of solace in William Blake, which probably gives you an indication of what my inner life was like. But I can answer that question sort of comfortably and fluently. I'm trying to pin down why you don't think people are interested in you, or you don't think people will be interested in the answers. I mean, you're a very successful artist, and it's not abnormal to be interested in how that journey began and unfolded.
It just feels like the things that I'm an expert in,
yeah,
the things that I can talk about.
You've got to be an expert in you, haven't you?
Well, I don't know if anyone ever really is. Like, that's my life and my childhood, and it's kind of... That's kind of private, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. I hadn't thought of it that way before. But I find it fascinating. I find people's gestation and development, especially if they're very creative, I'm fascinated by the building blocks in that process. But they are private. You're right.
And then once you say, oh, you know, I had a really tough time, this happened, or this was the moment when this happened, then that becomes the narrative of your life. And I think when you're a writer, you have to be cautious about just putting yourself in an awkward place where you say too much and then suddenly, oh, I just need to relax, everything's fine.
It's not tabloid newspaper journalism trying to get somebody in the public eye to say something they regret. I also think it's probably tied to something you've said in the past about being, when you were young, not being able to deal with the way that your mind works, you've spoken about. Is that the kind of thing you regret saying? Or is that the kind of thing that you can expand upon?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for a lot of young people, the world can feel like an assault.
Yes.
Growing up in South East London, where I grew up in Lewisham, there was a lot of quite troubling stuff going on around for friends. And it's the kind of place where things can be quite extreme. So your mental response to an extreme environment is often extreme as well. And I believe that we live in a time of a complete extremity. And often the most sane response to the insanity all around us is to slip a little bit, you know. But when I was young, I felt very passionate about music and literature, like very passionate. These were the things that I connected with almost like more fully, more forcibly at a particular time of in my development than with the real world, you know, the outside world.
Yes.
And through a very like engaged, passionate pursual of finding out more knowledge and finding out more, like have more access to them, I had this job in this record store. And there were these bookshops where you could get all the classics really, really cheap, like 20p for the Penguin classics with the black and orange spine, all things like that. And then I made lots of friends in my, when I was about 13 or 14 through a love of hip hop and rapping. And then my mind was kind of absolutely blown apart by live music, by what was happening in terms of hip hop events, like DJs that I met, like, music, it was live, it was real.
We interviewed Dave Haslam recently, and he talked about finding his tribe wherever he goes, wherever he's found himself in life. He's always somehow been able to find a tribe. It strikes me that's what you've just described, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel like that, especially when they are the kind of person who's, I think, born with the sensitivity of a poet. Like, you know, it's an extreme way of experiencing life. In Brazil, poet is a praise word.
Yes.
It's like, I would call you poet. It's a term of endearment.
Mm.
You know, you'd say, oh, my poet, when somebody's being particularly sweet-natured, sensitive, that's like lovely. Open, you know?
Yes, of course.
And I kind of have the idea about poet that I know people that have been writing poems all their lives, but I wouldn't necessarily call them a poet. And I know people that have never written poetry, but I think of them as poets. So I feel it's more like a kind of frequency that you're tuned into life at. And when you're of that frequency,
yes,
the minute you connect with others of that frequency, it's a big shock. You're
of
like,
course.
Wow, I found somebody else who has this thing in them. And the musicians that I met at that time, I still play with today.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be here doing this, having this chat with you, if it wasn't for the players and people that I met at that time. It's a beautiful thing to have community like that, musical community.
For sure. If we had to pin down what that frequency was.
I think the creative personality is a strange mix of like absolute conviction and a kind of crippling insecurity.
Mm.
And somewhere amongst all that, there's this very strong current, pushing yourself to the limits of experience so that you can really feel fully, you know, whether that's feeling fully empathy or feeling fully other things. It's important. If your sensitivities are open that way, I think.
Keats said in a letter, not in a poem, he said something like, oh, for a life of sensation rather than of thought.
Yeah, I could imagine him saying something like that in a letter.
But that's what I can kind of, that's what I'm hearing from you. It's as if when you talk about fully engaging, the insecurity is the thought. That's the kind of voices, and the poetry is the feeling, is the sensation, living.
Yeah, and also it's quite Blakey in that as well, isn't it? But, I mean, you can't have all sensation and no thought because you end up...
Well, you'd be a hedonist.
Not making much sense.
And also, you'd never get anything written down. So I'm not looking for a big epiphany moment, or I'm just looking for some chronology.
Okay.
When did you started rapping about 15 and 16? You described it quite beautifully as an ecstatic liberation from an anxious adolescence. But you were writing before you started performing, presumably. What were you writing and what did you get out of the process?
Everything, and I was writing terrible poems. Like,
just for yourself, mostly, was it?
Yeah, and stories. And I was seriously writing from about 7 or 8, like, seriously, that was my thing.
Yeah.
But then I stopped realising that what I was doing was writing.
Okay.
It wasn't something that I was kind of actively trying to do. It was just a part of how I needed to make sense of the world around me or my own place within it or whatever it was, things that were happening. I'd like to write down just happenings on the street or in a cafe or just at the bus stop. I would quite like to often just sit there and describe it, stand on the street and just describe it as it was going on, just to try and get better at pinning the words on the on the action. I still love to do that.
Getting the right words.
But you never can. It's an amazing thing happened yesterday. I got an honorary PhD from London Met.
Do I have to call you doctor?
You don't have to, but I mean, you could if you wanted to.
Technically, fantastic.
But what was amazing about it was that you sit on the stage with the faculty And then all of the students collecting their degrees come up to shake hands with the Vice Chancellor of the university. So I got to just sit there on this chair and watch 250 people, like, on a really important day in their lives, just come up, kind of beaming, like, all their families are in the audience. And I got to just look at all these faces, like, in a, like, unashamedly. Like, it was expected that we would be looking at these, like, beautiful faces. Everyone, you're just looking, thinking, like, how, there's no way, no matter how skilled you become with language, there's no way of fully being able to describe how much you learn from a person by observing their face or observing a small movement, some feature. And you can observe and observe and observe, but you can never imagine the movement that gives away the full depth of of kind of knowing that you feel when you watch somebody suddenly dance across the stage and everyone cheering, and then they get a bit shy the other side of the stage. And I don't know. It was.
Are you sure that you can never quite? Because I mean, that rather leads me to the question of why bother trying then.
Oh, because you try and you try and you try, but you'll never succeed. Like every time you write, you fail. That's to make artwork, to make theatre is to fail. There is no chance that anything you write will ever be as good as the idea, will ever be as pure as experience. It's always failure, and meeting that failure and persevering through that failure is what gives you the humility to become a writer, to become an artist, to become a theatre maker. Like, just knowing that this task is utterly hopeless.
How do you know you've finished then? Because, I mean, it's, I'm thinking about this. Beckett, who said, fail, fail again, fail better.
That's right.
That's a nutshell.
Ever tried, ever failed.
That's it.
Try again, fail again, fail well.
Fail better. Fail better.
That's what it is.
Well, it is. And I understand what that means, but I'm not a poet, or at least not publicly. But so how do you know? If you know that you failed, how do you know that you finished?
Oh, it's a completely different thing. Of course you know that you're finished. Like, you like...
Could you be any more dismissive of my question? I was quite pleased with that one.
Oh, sorry,
Tim. That's all right. I'm rolling with it.
I think that when you are creating a piece of work, you are always consulting the idea and trying to interrogate the idea and make sure that you can facilitate it, which you can never do successfully, but you try your best to do it. And then you begin by knowing where you want it to go, hopefully, and you end by knowing that's as much
that's
as you
as
can
far
give
as
it.
I can
as far
go.
As you can
so
go.
It's as if you're on a road. You're never going to reach the destination, but you know when your tank is empty. You
Who
know
said
when
it? Like, it's never finished, it's only abandoned.
Don't know. I like it.
Somebody, I think a writer... Also, there's, to be completely frank with you, you have deadlines.
This is true.
Finish, hand it in.
And that sort of focuses the mind a bit, especially if you've already spent the advance. That's usually a very good way of ensuring that you get the work done. I'm thinking self-taught. I mean, if you really weren't much into secondary school and yet your palette of reference culturally is immense. So you were, would you go with self-taught, or does that sound a bit pompous?
Well, I stopped going into school when I was about 13 or 14. I attended some classes. I attended a music class with a teacher that I loved. He's passed away now, actually. But I would go to those classes, and sometimes I would be sometimes in the school.
Yes.
But in a different room, like, just whatever. I wasn't really doing it. But I did take the exams.
Right.
At the end of the thing. And then I went on and I did a music BTEC at this college in Croydon called the Brit School, which was like... an insane place to go, because it's like a performing arts school. So you had music and you had theatre and you had film, you had kids studying like production, so people learning how to rig lighting gear. Amazing place, but quite a culture shock to just suddenly be around so many people so committed to their passions, their talents. That was really unusual. I went with my best mate.
Your best mate went to the school as well?
Both got in, went to the audition, did our thing. And then
what was your thing?
In my audition I was playing the guitar, just playing Spanish guitar.
Yeah. It's a very sort of, I mean, it's hard to get into the school. You talk about it quite casually, but
it was mental. I couldn't believe
massively
it.
Massively oversubscribed, isn't it?
It was amazing. Well, I was learning guitar there, but I stopped, and then I worked, and slowly I was giving more and more attention to the work that I was doing with my rapping outside school. And anyway, after all that, I did a part-time degree at Goldsmiths in New Cross, and that was incredible because I got access to the library there. So the reason I'm telling you all this stuff about that is because now I'm not self-taught. Like, I've been in contact with education my whole life, and also I've been in contact with an incredible community of other people.
Yes.
So I learned a lot from friends' mums and dads, like from experience, from my family, from books.
Yes.
That I just always very passionately would devour about lots of things. And then like when I hit Goldsmiths and I was doing these evening classes with these amazing people, you know, like there were small classes of people like, you know, that had been working all day and had kids and whatever, you know, yeah. And we'd come together in the evening and it'd be these quite rowdy discussion-based seminars and I'd never known anything like it. And I got this library card and so I got access to the library and I was reading academic books for the first time. I was doing like an introduction to politics. That was really, really inspiring, exciting class. You know, and like having to learn after not having been in academic study, I did study music, but it's not the same thing. You have
Of course. So you never, you got off the rails of formal education, but you just went exploring yourself through the kind of.
Yeah, and it was
uncharted,
amazing.
Not on rails, doing whatever you wanted, pursuing an enthusiasm. I find that interesting. So I'll read that. I'll go to this because I like that. Yeah. As opposed to the sort of classic.
Yeah, I got to pursue different pathways.
Yes.
Into areas that I didn't know anything about, you know.
When did you think about the future during this period? Because you've gone from secondary school to the Brit School to Goldsmiths. You've found your tribe. You've found your voice. When did you first, if indeed you did, it may have just sort of popped in, start thinking of a career, as it were?
Well, what's interesting is that there was never a moment where you think of a career.
Right.
What happens is you become obsessed to the point of there's no room for anything else. So when I discovered rapping, I was 15. When I started doing it myself, my own rapping, I was 15. I started doing it out loud at 16. And
where were you doing it before? Just at home in your own bed?
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to open my mouth and speak. And join the. I was hanging out with rappers and they would be rapping and I'd be listening, I'd be enjoying it, but didn't really feel like I was able to join the cypher yet. I had to do a bit more work privately.
Okay. Yes.
And then eventually at 16, I started to speak what I'd been writing. And then from that moment, there was no other colour in the palette. That was it. There was no other.
That was all you wanted to do.
It's not even wanted to. There was nothing else. Like that is it. That was life. Like,
just to explain a bit more, if you can, because that is, I think, for me, at risk of sounding pretentious, that's the difference between an artist and the rest of us.
My best mate, who I just mentioned, actually, he's a drummer, and he had music, and I had lyrics, and we both felt the same way about our creativity.
So the rest of us don't quite get this, do we?
But because there was people around me.
Yeah.
Coming with the same kind of commitment and passion to it, so I started to realise it was unusual.
Okay.
But there's a massive community of musicians in South London where I grew up, and there was a lot of space for us to meet and play. There was a lot of squats around. There was a lot of space for us to be able to play for free or for like a tenner for like 5 hours rehearsal. Mm. It was not absurd to spend 3 days playing music, getting a gig. It was just part of life, and it was very much part of how we socialised, part of how we understood ourselves, part of how we worked. Obviously, we had jobs, but everyone needs, day job. But the energy was always, always involved in thinking about lyrics, writing them, rehearsing, trying to put a band together, trying to get some gigs, trying to be heard, make a demo, make a CD, get a CD played.
So there's no plan, there's no route, there's no map. It's like a visceral need.
It's just it's like 16.
But I mean, 16-year-olds aren't necessarily that focused on doing something constructive and creative normally. But then you would even reject those words. You were just doing what you had to do.
I think that throughout my formative years and up until about the age of 21, I was just throwing myself completely at it and not realising that I was frustrated that I didn't know how to move beyond a certain point. But
you were frustrated.
Of course, when you get to...
Because you want more people to hear the words that you're...
Yeah, at that time I wanted to reach more, go further.
There you go. So that's an ambition, but it's not an ambition in a materialistic sense or in a popular sense. You just considered the work that you were doing to be important enough to demand and deserve a wider audience.
At that time, that's exactly how it felt. I think you want to push yourself to a point where you can be heard, and it, because it's It's an outward reaching ambition. It's a social ambition. You want to connect. It's about connection, I think.
Because you want people to be better to each other. That's why the more people that hear it.
I don't know where it comes from. Like maybe, I think maybe it's an, you know, an artist always has a huge ego. Otherwise, why on earth would you stand up on stage or sit down to write? So you have to separate the true creative ambition from the creative ego, and ask yourself, well, was I desperate to be heard because I was serving this higher purpose, which is what I thought I was doing at the time, or because I wanted to feel more justified in my personhood?
Yeah.
Because outside of having this identity that set me apart from others, then I could be bullied or laughed at, or whatever it is at that time. You know, you're an adolescent. You're trying to work out your place in the world. And when I'm looking back and trying to unpick that, I can't say it was a completely noble pursuit of a higher connection. Although, I mean, it was, but probably at the same time, I was just looking to like.
So you're conscious of that look at me, Gene, then, what you call as the ego, the bit of you that wonders, am I just doing this because I like being on a stage in front of hundreds or thousands of people?
Well, the thing is about that is that probably everybody who is on stage in front of that many people, I guarantee you, they might be up on that stage looking like they've never been afraid of anything in their lives. Yeah. But 45 minutes before they went up, I guarantee you they're in the dressing room with their head in their hands thinking, who do I think I am?
And
how am I going to do this?
Why do I keep doing this to myself as well? What answers do you come up with? Why do I keep doing this to myself?
Well, the thing is, it's not about... as you grow older and you become more secure in your personhood...
Yes.
And you... I... try and understand what it is about performance or creativity that I'm so bound to that.
Yes.
You understand more and more that it's nothing actually to do with you. The more you get involved in it, the more you get in the way, to be honest. Like, all being well, you're a channel. And that's a difficult thing to say because when people start talking about channeling. But what I mean by that is, in performance especially, you're trying to bridge a gap between audience and stage and language and imagination and individual and community. Like, you're really trying to bridge that gap. And if you can take yourself away from it and just let the words, let the music come through you, and you don't interfere with your nerves, with your anxieties, with your ego, with trying to please, trying to look after. If you just breathe and just let it happen, then you become this bridge. And then there is transcendence in the room. And like, it's insane. It's mad. It's mad when that happens.
How often does it happen?
It happens with Brand New Ancients, which was a long poem I wrote, which was the first, it was a 75 minute long poem, a story that had a lot of violence in it, but essentially was a kind of euphoric story. So it was a dark thing to summon, but at the same time, it ended with a very euphoric feeling. It was quite a taxing one to do, and I had not done that kind of thing before. In that transcendent moment would happen pretty much every night, but it was too much for me at the time, and I had to stop doing it because I thought that I was not going to be able to cope, and I would feel very drained. And once we were in New York, it was amazing. We'd got like the show had transferred to New York. It was in this amazing theater in Brooklyn, and there was all these people in the audience, and it was quite a steep rake, I think they call it, or bank of seats like that. So you could really feel the audience from all the way up there, all the way down. And we got about 10 minutes in, and basically I felt like I was going to have a panic attack, like my breathing. I just became really aware of like my skin, and everything just started going really weird. And I felt like I was like, I'm going to pass out or something. Yeah. And then basically what happened was I kind of.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I blacked out, like I wasn't there.
Right.
We got to the end of the spot, carried on,
yeah.
carried on with the words, got to the end of the show, like came off stage, like, and everyone, there was four musicians that played the show with me, and they were like, wow, that was a really amazing show. Like everyone stood up, like big standing ovation, everyone's going mental, like you feel like you've just died,
right.
and you're looking out and there's all these people like going mental. So what your brain is telling you is that when you suffer like that, it's good for them.
Oh gosh.
So I was there back, like out after the thing, like, I don't even know what happened. Like where?
Were you scared?
Yeah, because I thought like, what is that? Is that a panic attack? I don't know what that, I'd never had one of those before. So I didn't know if that was what it was. And then I was talking to my friend who's a musician. He's a guitarist. He talks about guitarists talking about that happening. You yeah. black out and you can play like you've never played before. So then if that's the case, if as musicians and performers, we're aspiring to get to this place where essentially we're so afflicted by the reality of like trying to go out there and do it that the best thing that can happen to you is that you black out.
Yeah.
Danger. I felt like there was a dangerous element going on that I wasn't strong enough to hold. So that I decided that I couldn't do that anymore. I wasn't supported enough. Sure. I didn't have the experience.
But people wouldn't know how to support you, would they? Really? Because it's such uncharted water for almost everybody.
Now I've learned that there are ways.
Yes.
There are ways to make that experience like more positive and safer for the people that are on stage.
Because it is scary. Are we talking about the same thing then? It's interesting, the words are so different. To black out is to transcend.
Well, but when I was talking about the kind of the transcendent moment,
yeah.
I didn't mean that time.
No.
But like...
But that was transcendent.
But that's what I'm saying, yeah. That was probably...
The most,
right? But for me, it was...
Terrifying.
It was really dark.
Where were you?
I was in this... theatre in New York.
Yeah, but where were you?
Oh, I've got no idea. That's what I'm saying, James. It was, it was a mad time for me in my life anyway.
Sure.
It's a big pressure, like, you know, that show was a big pressure. Anyway, now, with Let Them Eat Chaos, which was the last album that we did, that was a kind of similar, in a lot of ways, a similar process. It's a long story. But that, it was just completely different because there was so much hope. I think it was the violence in Brand New Ancients that made it such a burden.
Right.
Because every night you have to summon this violence into the room. It's a sexual violence,
yes.
And it's a hard thing to summon into your body and say, okay, that's where we're going to go. And you have to be responsible for taking people there. And we've Let Them Eat Chaos, it was it's positive. It's just much more positive. You know, the message is more positive. So we were more protected on stage by what we were saying. So when you go out and you start the story, you feel more secure in where you're taking the people. Like you feel like you're asking them to come with you on this journey, and you feel much more secure asking them because you know it's going to end well. You know,
so it's exposure and vulnerability, but of two different flavors: one dangerous and one ultimately uplifting, or redemptive. Is that a word that would fit here?
The thing is, like words spoken in public places are very powerful things.
Of course,
like in dark rooms.
Yeah,
you know, like with lots of people with drums. Like this is ancient. This is like powerful stuff.
Yeah, of course it is.
And you can't take it lightly.
It's
and
primal.
There's something that happens.
I think so.
To our bodies on stage.
Yes.
To the bodies in the audience. You can't like just because it's the music industry is a huge machine, and ever since the Beatles, people go on tour. You know, and da da da. You can't forget that what you're doing is like, it's really amazing. It's like, it's a very special moment that these people have come out, like no matter what's happened in their day, they've booked a ticket to this thing. Maybe their friend got them a ticket. They've had to get on the train. They've had to leave whatever's going on. They've probably forgotten they had to do it. Then they've run out the door, and then everyone's got their own journey that they're bringing into this room. And then they all stand together. Everybody's experience is directly affected by the people around them and how they are experiencing. And then you come out and you meet all of this mass of experience and you start telling a story. You can't take it lightly. You have to give it the respect it deserves. And, you know, without wanting to sound too far-fetched or too much of a lovey, like that is how I feel about it. It's like, okay, performance for me is stagecraft is extremely important because it's very heightened. It's like, it's access to community, direct access, you know. So now I feel much more secure in my stagecraft maybe I could tackle something like Brand New Ancients again, but I don't think I would want to. But moving on,
yeah,
I feel more and more excited by the possibility of what, like a gathering of people to hear poems, to hear, they're like, it's like spells, you know, it's like, you know, sermons and all this stuff. The reason it's so powerful, that religious language, because like you're standing listening to somebody speak, tell these stories. I don't like, fancy myself as a preacher, but something happens that's a bit unusual when there's poems and music.
And an audience.
Yeah, but even if it's
does
just
it
one
when
other
there's
person.
No audience?
I've never really tried it. You don't get in the same place.
Do you not? So when you're writing and composing, it's never actually finished until you've done it in front of people.
It's definitely not the same as when...
That's interesting.
Because when you're writing, it's one thing, you're the writer.
Yes.
When you're composing, it's one thing, you're composing. When you become the performer of the text, you, in a lot of ways, you have to forget that you're the writer of it. You have to memorize it, that's one thing, put it in your body and let it come through you. It's a completely different experience. And it's all about communication. When you're writing, you're in service to the idea. When you're on stage, you're in service to communication. You're trying to be this bridge. It's completely different experiences. Like the written text is one thing, finished when it's performed, but this new book of poems that I've written, I won't perform.
More from Kate imminently, but here's Russell Cain to tell you about his new show on Joe.
Hi, Russell Cain here, and I'm hosting a brand new podcast for Joe, Boys Don't Cry, where I get a bunch of men together and force them to talk about the things we never talk about. Body hair, body shape, why do girls only fancy bastards? All the things we worry about but never discuss. Oh, and I'll also have a girl helping me each week just to make sure we're not talking rubbish. So go to wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, wherever, and download Boys Don't Cry now.
Cheers, Russell. Now, back to Kate Tempest.
It's not right to tour these poems. I think that they will perform better.
You think other people
more
might?
Intimately with somebody reading them, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because of the nature of the poems and the brevity of them and the importance of the page and the space around them and also the time it takes to read. I think they should be read slower, and I have a tendency to kind of try and meet the space and go too loud and
fast. Right. So it's a more contemplative project.
I still think people should read poems aloud even if they're reading them to themselves.
I do. Yeah, I think probably we'd all benefit from having a little bit more poetry in our life. But when I say that, I sound glib. Do you see? Don't I? That's why you're laughing at me.
No,
I do. I sound a bit glib. And yet when you say it, I don't know whether it's because you suffer for your art. There's a torturous air sometimes to the way you analyse the process. I wonder if you ever wish you didn't have that. I mean, you wouldn't be Kate Tempest. You wouldn't be the winner of a Ted Hughes Prize and a double Mercury Music. But there's a pain involved in what you're describing to me that I wonder whether sometimes you wish you were made slightly differently.
What I can say to that is that this dream that I had when I was a kid, this compulsion that took over my life, has become something that I am able to do for a career. And that is unbelievable. I'm so grateful. I feel so privileged, so blessed. I've had so much support from so many different places. Every single time I have a creative conversation with another practitioner, I feel so full of gratitude that this can be my life. This is unbelievable. It's extremely powerful to think back to the kids that we were, telling each other, not if but when. Not if but when. Come on, we just gotta, like, we're gonna do this, like, this is gonna happen for us because it's for the greater good and da-da-da-da. Like, oh, I remember all these things. And, like, when I put that... when I stand on the line that goes back to the beginning and I position myself on that line, I can't believe how beautiful, what a beautiful thing to be able to live a creative life.
And most people who said not if but when in their teens didn't get to lead the life that you do.
Well, I think that, like, one thing that is sad is that you can be brutalized by the experience of being alive. There is a lot that happens to a person that can make them lose some of their openness. And, like, creative careers aside,
sure,
that is the sad element, and that happens too often and because of so many things. But no matter what happens in life, and I know this from experience, you can retain your integrity and you can retain your openness. And
it's
that's
not easy. What do we mean by integrity, Kate?
Well, your service to your ideas, you know?
I do. And so you spend a lot of time thinking about process, a lot of time thinking about personhood, a lot of time defining the parameters of your professional and personal existence. And they're blurred, right? You don't separate the two.
Well, actually, increasingly, I do.
But you think you have to flick a switch and...
Well, just like when I'm having, like, my life now, you know, it's Kate Calvert who hangs out with her partner or hangs out with her sisters or a brother or mum and dad. And that, like, luckily, that isn't the same person that has to go out on stage and do all the bits that that person has to do.
But they're both real people.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, they're both real people.
It's because I've interviewed a lot of artists for a very long time. And it's fascinating to speak to somebody who is so comfortable talking about the stuff that the rest of us don't really experience, you know?
Well, you do experience it.
We experience the end result of it. And occasionally I understand most of what you're saying about transcending and most of what you're saying about creative urges. But I guess the difference between every adolescent that's ever written a poem and what you're describing to me is need. It's necessity. What would happen to you if you somehow were prevented from writing?
I don't know. I mean, like...
it's oxygen.
The thing about transcendent, it's a funny word to use because it's got so many connotations.
But do you know, it's the word I had in my head before you said it, and I was trying to pluck up the courage to say it out loud to you, and I didn't need to.
Maybe a better way of describing it for your listeners, so it doesn't sound like such a load of kind of jargon.
I don't think it does sound like jargon.
Like, you know, it sounds a bit far-fetched.
So we've all got a concept of being taken out of ourselves by art. I'm just not familiar with speaking to the artist about it. As a consumer of art, I can mention the moments in my life where I've almost been floating above the
this
room.
Is it. But
as that would be as an audience member rather than as a performer.
The best way to describe it is music.
Yeah.
How music feels. Like, that's it. That's where you go when you make music. So you go to the same place that music takes you. It's unbelievable. Yeah. I can't, like, it's so beautiful. And then sometimes it really isn't. Sometimes it's like an absolute nightmare and you can't get there and it doesn't make any sense. And you're just like throwing yourself against these brick walls, you know?
But you have to do that to have the successful moments.
I think presumably. So. Like, at the minute, like, I'm working on a novel and I'm finding it really hard. And,
what do you mean when you say you're finding it really hard? Are you struggling to sit down and write?
No, it's not that.
I didn't think it would be. You're struggling to like the stuff you've done.
I don't know what I'm doing. You know,
really? Like, how far into it are you?
About 2/3 in to the first draft. And I'm having a bit of a crisis. But, I mean, the thing is, this is what I know in my sober mind, is that I have these... And this is maybe it's quite useful for people to know.
Go on.
Every single time I make anything new, I have a complete kind of artistic rejection of the idea of myself. Like, you know, you battle with this inferiority complex and you can't do it. Every single time I'm about to do anything, whether it's a gig or an interview or whatever it is, there's a part of me that is sure that I cannot do it. It will not be done. It is no good. And then the flip side of it is this conviction, this like mad conviction that's like basically this kind of seesaw of like, I can't do it. What am I doing? To like, there is nothing else for me to do. I must be able to do this. I'm going to get it done. And it, sometimes it's happening at the same time of like, you know, you're having this awful day at the desk and everything you've written is a nightmare. And at the same time, you know, you're making progress and you know that it's going to pass because it's happened every single other time before. And all those times you made the work, all those times you got on stage and you did the gig, even though you knew that you weren't going to be able to do it, but the rational mind, you know intellectually that it's going to be fine, but what you experience in your body emotionally is like, you know, like just crippling...
doubt.
Yeah.
So it's not the same as imposter syndrome. It's not that you feel you're a fake and you're going to be found out. You never feel like that.
But like, you may be found out by the idea that you don't have what it takes...
On this occasion,
to do
this job, to do this piece.
It's so mad. But then I think people must have that with work, you know, with any vocation.
Yeah, but that's why I mentioned imposter syndrome or feeling, because that's not what I'm hearing from you. And almost every other guest we've had on Unfiltered at some point has alluded to a sense of fear that you're going to get a tap on the shoulder and told, all right, you've had your fun, go and get a normal job now, go and get a job in a shop or an office.
Yeah. I feel that. Like,
you get that as well.
Everybody has that.
But the way that you create is so profound that you must, it's not quite
how have I ended up getting away with this? That's not what we're describing.
No. Sometimes it's that. Yesterday on the stage of getting my PhD from these amazing people, I was like, this is bonkers. Like, you do have that moment, but yeah, I don't know. It's a bit more like, how on earth am I going to get away with this rather than how have I got away with
okay.
it? It's how am I going to do... Look, to be honest with you, like, this isn't going to last forever. I'm not stupid.
Why not?
Well, because it doesn't. Like, this is not how the trajectory of making artwork and people listening to it, it does not last forever. People will stop listening. I will fall out of favour. Like, whatever, it's going to happen. And at that point, I will still be making work. And I know that. Like,
right.
And when I can't get
published... So you're just describing the size of the audience.
Like, well, I think what I mean is that knowing that is pretty healthy. It means that you're not afraid of the moment the tap on the shoulder comes, because you know it's going to come. Like, I have a real passion to teach one day. Like, I think that would be incredible. I'd love to do that, you know. And I think that all of this, what I'm talking about, the kind of anxieties of stage and stuff, you don't want to do that forever. You don't want to put yourself through that when you don't feel strong enough to go through that. It should be a choice, not an obligation.
Yeah, okay. All right. I get that. I don't know that I agree with you, that it will come to an end, but I can see why it's liberating to believe that it will. That's what you're saying.
I think it's realistic, you know?
Like, yeah, it might be, but there are some people that go the distance. You know, there's Bowie, and there are plenty of people who manage to have a lifelong career of weapons-grade creativity.
That's true.
But it's probably liberating to think that you won't be one of them, even if you end up being one of them.
Because that's the other thing, like, part of every artist, and maybe, in fact, I know yourself, in fact, every single listener likes to think to themselves that they have what it takes to go the distance.
Yeah.
Like, I have it, like, I can, what I have to, but at the same time, like, you shouldn't, I believe that you shouldn't kind of count yourself among the greats, but you should be in communication with them, and you should see them as counsel, you know, like, I don't think that you should feel inferior. To great works of art or great artists, that you're on a level with them. They're here to teach you. They've got lessons for you to learn.
And it's a give and a take. So you have to feel part of a tradition, part of a process, part of a broader narrative, which brings us to the new book, which is, you've mentioned it.
Seamless.
That's what I do, mate. Seriously. Are you taking notes?
It's transcendent.
Let's not get carried away. Running upon the wires. You've given us some sort of clues as to what can be expected. Are people going to be surprised? I mean, are people who are familiar with Everybody Down and Let Them Eat Chaos and some of your other work, are they going to be surprised by this book? Is it what the critics would call a departure?
Yeah, it is. I think all of the things that I've made have been...
You do what you want to do.
From each other. Yeah, I mean...
So where did this come from?
So Running Upon the Wires is a new collection of poems that charts the end of my marriage into heartbreak and despair, and then out into the kind of redemptive glow of new love, and then even further into domesticity and buying new sheets. And the idea being that rather than it just being like a kind of breakup album, I thought the more useful prospect to offer the world was to stay with the speaker of these poems and see it through. And rather than finish there in the heartbreak, see it through, you know, make no bones about it. It's pretty, you know, it's depression and drunkenness and promiscuity and all the stages of heartbreak. Yeah. But then, to see it through and to not stop there and to keep going with the poems. And so it's actually, they're very short poems and they're quieter poems and
so they're
more
moments,
intimate.
Moments in your...
They're poems.
Yeah.
It's a book of poems.
Was it always a book of poems?
Yeah. I've been writing it, so it's the last, you know, the way that it works when you're on the road and da-da-da and you're making work and you're writing what you can in your time in between whatever else is going on, whatever else you're working on. And this is just what's been happening over the last few years, and so these are the poems that have been kind of coming out. And I spoke to my editor, Don Patterson, and I sent him a few poems like a couple of years ago. I said, this is what's going on, this is where I'm at. And he was like, well, okay. Maybe it's a book of love poetry, and maybe that's okay. Like, you know, I've always written these, in all of my poetry collections, there have been the more tender poems and more intimate poems about relationships. But the conceit of actually sticking with the relationship poetry was like something pretty terrifying.
Why?
Because this will be the first time the perspective has been the first person.
Yes. Why do you do it to yourself?
I think it's... I think it's really useful and a really beautiful thing to offer the world. Like,
so you're making the personal universal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that with this, the I in the poem is not, it doesn't distance you. I feel like the I becomes you for the readers. I think so.
Yeah.
It, also, it's like, I mean, it's just a mad thing to say, but like, you know, I've got a deadline. Got a, this is what I've been writing.
You finished
this
now.
This is what's happening.
It's out in September.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, I was thinking, well, I could write a whole other book of poems that isn't about what's just been happening in my life, but this is what I've got. So,
and the poems would be there even if you weren't published. You'd be writing the poems to deal with the... Or is this a slight departure in the sense that this is part of a progression?
Well, hopefully all the work is a progression. Like, of hopefully. Course. But
professional progression, then?
In terms of my professional progression... Yeah. I feel like the way that I work is in like chunks. So okay. I would count Wasted, which is my first play, and Hopelessly Devoted and Brand New Ancients and Everybody Down and The Bricks That Built the Houses on one hand. That's like a chunk of work. It all belongs together. Let Them Eat Chaos is kind of in the middle. It's right. That's a little stepping stone into a new chunk. And then there are four or five things that form a new constellation. That's yes. The best way to think of them. They're like constellations. They have relationships to each other.
And you don't know what those relationships will be until it's all finished. And even then you don't really know, but you know that they are.
Yeah, well, they come, their gestation overlaps, their creation overlaps. So I'll be writing them all at the same time. I'll be touring one thing, editing another. Okay. So they're part of each other's growing up.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But yeah, it's interdependent. In a sense,
yeah.
They feed off each other and speak to each other. And
so Running Upon the Wires is the first of a new...
And do you know at this point what else is going to be in that constellation?
Yeah.
Are you comfortable talking about it, or do you...
There's a new album, which it will follow in April, which is also a departure, you know, is a new... And there's a play that I'm working on, which will be probably... Which hopefully will be ready in next year, maybe. And that's also a departure and is part of this kind of new set. And then if I ever finish this novel that I'm trying to smash out, then that will be a part of it as well.
Spend the advance.
I have to submit it before I get the advance.
You? He's getting your agent.
Just gonna get.
You don't have ambition in a conventional sense. Then you're not. You don't. Do you worry about money and stuff like that? Because
what in terms of will this book make money?
No, I was thinking more about something Martin Amis has called tramp angst, which he. Has and Christopher Hitchens doesn't, and they used to discuss it. So they both were making. One of them believed it was still possible for him to end up sleeping on a park bench, and the other one had done the sums and realised that he was never going to. It's emotional rather than financial or statistical.
Right. Okay.
But when you were talking about discovering your tribe and being in squats and doing stuff that you needed to do, it struck me that you probably never really worried about financial security or a mortgage-free existence.
Well, the thing is, is that. At the minute, I don't have to worry because of all the work that I've been doing.
Yeah.
About the rent for for a few months. You know, you've done enough. This stuff, it's all there. You're in this moment which you've been working towards your whole life of being able to support yourself comfortably with your work, so that you can do your work, right? And then this is what I'm saying earlier about it's not going to last. But like I talk about it with my partner, and it's like, well. If we get to a point where I have to get a job or like a normal job, then that's what's going to happen. Like,
and that doesn't
it's not
going
to break my heart to get a job. Like, it's going to be obviously a bit of a shock to suddenly not be on stage and to be like, you know, doing something else. But teaching would be great, or like caring somehow, nursing. Like, I could train that. Like, there's loads of things that I would like. There's other lives.
You're not. This is the final question. You are not frightened of it all ending tomorrow, or are you trying really hard to convince yourself that you're not frightened?
It would be heartbreaking for like many reasons, but it might be the best thing for the work if no one was listening to it. You know, because like I don't, that might be absolute nonsense, but like I think where I'm at right now, I'm in a beautiful relationship. I'm very happy and I'm in love. And it gives me a very strong feeling of security.
Yes.
About like, no matter what else happens, actually, like this relationship that I'm in is so beautiful. And it gives me so much courage in my work, in my calling, my purpose as an artist that, I believe in it. in love and in creativity, which is an act of love. And I kind of think because I'm in that moment, if I don't have to come and do interviews anymore, if I don't get to go and play gigs around different places, like,
you'd still be blessed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I hope, please, I'd still be able to write, and I wouldn't get bitter, and I wouldn't be one of them. I could have been a contender, you know. I would really, really hope that it can be 20 years down the line, and I can still be feeling fresh with it.
I think you're going to be all right.
We'll see.
I think you're going to be all right, Kate Tempest. Thank you.
Thanks, James O'Brien.
It's really lovely. I think that the first 5 minutes of that interview were the closest I've come since we started doing Unfiltered to thinking that we weren't going to reach the end of the hour. It's no criticism of Kate. She just sort of made me feel uncomfortable because I don't think she felt very comfortable. Hopefully, shortly after those 5 minutes expired, and certainly long before the end of our hour together, we both felt a lot more comfortable. I know I did, and therefore managed to create something a bit special together. If you did enjoy that, you might want to check out Lily Allen's episode of Unfiltered. It's certainly very surprising in places. Here's a clip.
You know, when I got pregnant with my first, it was at the height of being chased by paparazzi. And
is that horrible?
Yeah, it was really intimidating.
And when you tell the story of how you achieved fame, that was never part of your desire, though, because some people, Kardashians, for example, presumably dreamt of the day when their limousine would be chased down.
Listen, if I'd have known where it was that I was heading, or if I, that had been my goal, I wouldn't have signed such a tiny deal with EMI.
Okay, no, I understand.
You know, if I'd have thought where I was going, where I ended up going, then sure, I would have asked for a lot more fucking money.
So do go back and check that out, along with the rest of the Unfiltered back catalogue. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the series. Leave a rating and a review on iTunes. And if you know someone else who might like Unfiltered, then do them a massive favour and introduce them to it.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.